Okay, round two. Name something that's not boring.
A laundry? Ooh, a book club. Computer solitaire, huh?
Ah, oh, sorry, we were looking for Chumba Casino. That's right, ChumbaCasino.com has over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. ChumbaCasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to the Gluten Free Voice. I am Jules Shepherd, Jules Gluten Free, and also from the organization 1and133.org. I know some of you who are listening are familiar with that because we are on here tonight to talk about the FDA's recent issuing of the final regulations pertaining to gluten-free food labeling laws. And 1133 was a big part in that. And so I know there's a lot of folks who are listening who are familiar with 1 and 133. I am very excited, though, tonight to be welcoming onto the show my dear friend Andrea Lavario from the American Celiac Disease Alliance. And aside from being my friend and co-conspirator, so to speak, in 1 and 133, she is the executive director of the American Celiac Disease Alliance, which is basically the advocacy voice of the celiac community in Washington, D.C. Welcome, Andrea, to the show. Thank you for joining us, taking time out of your crazy schedule in the midst of all of this to come on and help explain these regulations.
Oh, thank you for having me. Glad to be here.
Well, and Andrea has been around with these regulations for quite a while because the history here goes farther back than I think a lot of people even realize. Andrea was involved with this Celiac Disease Alliance has been involved for a number of years when the Food Allergen Consumer Protection Labeling Act of 2004 was really coming into being. That's when our community kind of galvanized to form this organization that Andrea is now the executive director for. So I wonder, Andrea, if you could give us a little bit of background for those who aren't familiar with FALCPA, the Food Allergen Consumer Protection Labeling Act of 2004. You know, how did gluten-free fit into that? And maybe that will give some folks some perspective on why we're just now getting to the gluten-free portion of the regulations that Congress had asked the FDA to put forward.
Sure. So in 2003, a group of the leaders from the celiac community, from the centers, some of the food manufacturers and the support organizations, came together, and it was shortly after the landmark prevalence study had been published and revealing that 1 in 133 Americans had celiac disease, or roughly 3 million people, and they knew and expected that people would now be diagnosed at a greater rate, and once diagnosed, of course, without a medical treatment, no pill or anything like that, they had to be able to eat, and unlike other parts of the world, gluten or the grains, gluten-containing grains were not required to be disclosed on product labels. So by sheer fortune, I guess, Dr. Fasano happened to be the physician for my son, and he knew I worked with Congress, and he asked if I would help them work on this allergen on, you know, a labeling bill. And about the same time, there was already legislation sort of working its way through, or starting to work its way through Congress, to require the top 8 allergens to be labeled. And we had a number of conversations with congressional staff and members of the House and the Senate, and explained to them the importance of having the grains that were of concern and problematic for people with celiac disease listed on the labels. A number of folks wanted the label to include the term gluten. Unfortunately, there is no universal definition for that word, and the food industry balked at that very strongly and said if gluten was on the label, they would basically shut the bill down. And so that was...
Meaning that the top eight food allergens wouldn't even be labeled.
Right, exactly. And so that was the first round. The second round came around, the second time the bill came back up. So that was 2002. 2003, we were back at it again. And the starting point was just the top eight allergens. Gluten was not even on the table and was not even open for discussion. So at that point, we realized about 90%, maybe a little bit more percent of the issues for people with celiac disease really related to wheat and wheat derivatives being disclosed. So we knew that that would take us very far, but we also wanted very much to have something else available beyond that to that would address both barley and rye. And so we insisted that the gluten-free regulation language be included in the bill, and we were fortunate that it was in the final bill that was ultimately signed into law. So once the bill was finished on August 2nd, 2004, it was signed into law. We're getting very much very well at August 2nd.
I'm seeing a pattern.
Landmark there. Right after it was signed into law, we immediately started having discussions with FDA about, okay, so now how do we move forward on the next steps, and worked with them throughout the process and through what many people have called the dark days where, you know, it seemed like nothing was really happening. But, you know, for those...
Well, and just to clarify, with that regulation, the Food Allergen Consumer Protection Labeling Act of 2004, while it did require manufacturers to label items that contained the top eight food allergens, including wheat, it did not require a labeling of barley or rye, the other two gluten-containing grains, but it did say in a different section of the provision, which is what you all worked so hard for, that the FDA was tasked with defining gluten and defining gluten
to.
For labeling. Right.
Right.
And that was, they were supposed to have done that by 2006?
August of 2006, they were supposed to have the proposed rule out available for us to review. They missed that deadline by about 5 months. It came out in January. And then it was supposed to be final in August of 2008. So from 8 to 13 was the 5 years that we waited for it to be completed.
Right.
And then
and
in
so
the interim,
we
went through another iteration that came out in 2011.
Right. So, yeah, and that's what I think a lot of folks who are listening will have some familiarity with, is that, you know, the community started to go, okay, now wait a minute, this is supposed to have been done, and we don't have anything yet. So in 2011, that's when 1in133.org was formed, and we built the world's tallest gluten-free cake, and we had the gluten-free labeling summit where Congresswoman Loewy and McCollum came, and Deputy Director of the FDA, Michael Taylor, came, and the community was really galvanized around the petition drive and also just getting in the same room with the FDA and saying, this is really important to us. And there were, I think we were all pretty shocked to hear that the FDA really didn't even have it on their to-do list. I mean, it was like it was out there, but they didn't think that because it was voluntary that there was really much that they needed to be doing. And once they saw the community was very eager to have these regulations, you know, out there, he was true to his word, Deputy Director Michael Taylor was, and in August of 2011, they sort of started the ball rolling again and issued the draft regulations, essentially the same ones that they had issued in 2007 and never finalized, had the comment period and all of that. And then we've been in a waiting game since then to find out when these were going to be finalized. And in August 2nd of this year, again, that wonderful date, and that was last Friday, that's when we got word that they had been finally finalized. So that's a short history of a long process, but I think it's important for people to know how long the American Celiac Disease Alliance and all of those folks who have been passionately working for gluten-free food labeling regulations, how long we all have been working for that. Because, you know, when people look at what we have now as the food regulations, which we're going to start talking about, right now, some people aren't totally happy with what they are, but they were a long time in coming, and they were, I think they're a great first step for us to look forward to them being implemented and being a really great step in the right direction towards safety for gluten-free consumers. So thank
right.
you for the background.
Well, and I think one thing that people may not be aware of as well is in between the time of the first proposed rule closed, which was in April of 2007, the study that was conducted by Dr. Fasano and Dr. Katassi that demonstrated that 20 ppm was safe had not been published. So FDA did not even have that research to rely on as they went forward. It was published right after that. So when mm-hmm. they, between the time of the first proposed and the second proposed, we can say safely, the science changed. And
right.
FDA now had the science from that study, which is really the best hard study out there today. And in the interim years, we also saw that the Codex Alimentarius change and have a 20 ppm standard. So it was those intervening years really were critical to shifting what was happening in terms of moving this ball forward, as well as a 10-foot cake. But there were things that were happening around us and in the world that were key, or we may not even be where we are today.
Right. Well, and just to back up, the Codex Alimentarius is sort of equivalent to what the FDA kind of put out with regard to gluten for the U.S. It is the European version of that, and it's been done for much longer and has established that less than 20 parts per million is a safe amount of gluten for people who are on a gluten-free diet for medical reasons. So that's what Codex means. But the I think that's a really interesting point that you make about the science, and I think a lot of people are, questioning that 20 parts per million standard. So maybe you could just flesh that out just for a moment, because you did mention that it's really the only hard science out there. That's what the FDA was basing their rule on, right? It was really looking at what the science is, what they could actually say was proven at this point in today's medical world as being a safe level for celiacs.
Well, I mean, they looked at that research that was out there and, what is being done in other countries and how did they, come to set their standards. They also conducted what's called a safety assessment, and there were two different methods that FDA could use to determine, what would be the safety factor for the regulation. And this is a situation where the lack of science was a problem, because while there is a great deal of science about determining what is safe thresholds or what is safe and or analyzing what could be safe with regard to people with food allergies, there is almost no research on that topic for people with celiac disease. And the impact of someone accidentally eating gluten is very different than for some food allergies in which you could die. And so how you balance those two was an issue for FDA to come. How do you reconcile that? Because they are two very, very different things. Although, what we often say is, well, we may not die today, over the long term, if we are, inadvertently getting gluten, it could have long-term health consequences. So it took time for FDA to really work through that, and they are very conservative, they want to make sure that the science is right to be protective. And at the same time, they had to look at what will it do to the marketplace. You always have to balance what's happening with industry at the same time, and particularly in this case, because food is what we're relying on. So if the standard were set too low, you would have a potential for industry to say, we're going to leave the marketplace, or products wouldn't be made any longer, or they wouldn't be labeling them anymore, and that would make it more difficult for individuals to comply with a diet. So that would pose, another set of issues. Then the other issue, too, is when you look at the testing methods, the tighter the standard, the variability goes up. And so at 5 ppm, the variability in the test is higher than it is if the standard is at 20 ppm. There's less variability. So you have to, they have to look at those factors as well in terms of how are we going to enforce this. So, you know, there's a number of factors that had to be considered before they could arrive at what we think is the best place today. You know, we would all like to see it lower if the science takes us there. But for today, I think that FDA made the right decision.
Well, and I think that's a really good point that we should talk a little bit more about. I solicited questions through my blog post on blog.julesglutenfree.com, as well as Facebook and Twitter, for people to chime in with their questions about, you know, their concerns about the legislation, or rather the regulations, and also just, you know, understanding how they would be implemented. And one question that came in from Sandra was, you know, what about this testing? Because you just were talking about there are tests that can test a little bit more, you know, to a lower level than what the 20 parts per million is that the FDA has set. And she says, I have a home test kit certified accurate that tests down to 10 parts per million, and I understand that there are more sophisticated tests that can test down to 3 parts per million. If under 20 parts per million is allowable, then the food can contain anywhere from 0 to 19 parts per million. And she's concerned, why can't we use a test that tests to lower than that and therefore lower the standards? So that's sort of what you were talking about a second ago with the variability. But could you just address that question a little more specifically?
Sure. Yes, there are tests that test to a lower standard. But the question is a lower standard necessarily safe? There isn't, the research doesn't, we don't have a research, there is not research out there that says that a patient is safer at 3 ppm than they are at 20 ppm. It doesn't exist yet, and hopefully it will at some point. You would think by the fact that it is lower that it would be safer, but there's no way of knowing that because you don't actually know when you look then at what the variability is in the test. Were you really getting 3, or were you getting 7, or were you getting 10? And the same at 10. Were you getting 5, or were you getting 15 or 20? There's, you know, those are questions that we really can't answer. And I think the concern was industry has said yes, they can do 20. A number of folks said that yes, they can do it lower, they can test lower, and the certification programs are testing at a lower threshold. There was concern about what would this mean for the marketplace, and since this is the only course of treatment for people with celiac disease, that you run the risk of product leaving the market and making it more difficult for people to comply with the diet. And that is a concern that, you know, we have to consider, you know, in terms of how the standard was set. If the standard was not safe, I can feel confident saying that FDA would not have set the standard at 20 ppm, and likewise, we wouldn't have an international standard at 20 ppm.
Right. Well, and maybe it would also help to answer the question of, let's say, you know, in 2014, a new study comes out showing that, you know, in fact, celiacs are harmed at 20 parts per million, but they're not harmed at 15 parts per million. I'm totally throwing these numbers out. This is not scientific in any way. I'm just, you know, throwing out a scenario. Under these regulations, how or would the FDA then reconsider their standard?
The numbers you gave, I think, are a little too close together for it to be.
Yeah, well, okay, then say 10.
But,
I mean, it doesn't matter,
but
if it was different.
Right. I mean, we said in our comments to the FDA that if the science shows that it is safer to go lower, that it is more protective of the patient, then yes, FDA must consider that science, and we would recommend that they go lower. And FDA has said the exact same thing in the summary of the proposed or of the final rule, that they will monitor the science to see if it needs to be adjusted, and we will hold them to that, absolutely.
Okay, great. Well, and that's the answer that I was looking for, because I think, you know, a lot of people are concerned. They're not happy with the 20 parts per million, and they think that we're stuck with that, and we're not necessarily stuck with that because the science is at 20 parts per million now, but it may be that it changes at some point in the future, and we'll know that. But I think, you know, what I always say to people, and this doesn't have anything to do really with the FDA's new regulations, you mentioned earlier the independent certification agencies. If you're someone who believes that you're sensitive to a degree below 20 parts per million, you always have the option of purchasing certified gluten-free products from either the GFCO certification, the CSA certification, even the QAI now has a certification with the NFCA. Those are certified to 10 parts per million or less. And so you can seek out those products that are certified and know that you're actually getting something that is 10 parts per million or less. But in order to, you know, meet the needs of international trade and to juggle and balance really all of the different considerations that you mentioned earlier about, you know, the marketplace and compliance and having options and affordability and all of that, I believe that's, you know, why the FDA had netted out where it did with the science, which shows to date that, you know, less than 20 parts per million is not harmful to someone who has celiac disease.
Right, and I should say that if I could just go back one second, the study that was actually done by Dr. Pisano found that this is a safe, they found that 50 ppm was safe. So they built in a safety factor themselves and said, based on that, we're going to go down two levels and say that 20 ppm is where the standard should be set. So a safety factor.
And that was taken
into
account. Right, and that's taking into consideration that the manufacturers could still meet the 20 parts per million, and it's even more stringent than what they needed to have according to the science.
Right.
Okay. Well, let's talk about the regulations now, because I think a lot of people are curious, you know, what they actually do say and what they do mean. First of all, just because they came out on August 2nd, that does not mean that they are, quote, in effect yet. They will actually go into effect in 1 year. I believe it's August 5th. Is that the date of when all of the manufacturers
D-Day.
Have to be complying? Yeah, D-Day. August 5th of 2014.
D-Day. We'll call it G-Day. Yes, the date of publication 1 year later. So the rule was actually effectively published on August 5th, so 1 year from Monday. So that would be August 5th, 2014. Companies will have to be in compliance with the regulation by that date. However, FDA is encouraging companies to come into compliance sooner.
Well, and I think any manufacturer who's been paying attention at all to this marketplace and to what's going on had an idea that this was coming, so they should be already moving in that direction.
Right. In terms of the standard, this was no surprise.
Right. Okay. Well, let's talk about then, in addition to, you know, that a manufacturer has to comply with a less than 20 parts per million standard if they want to label their products gluten-free. What else do these regulations say?
Well, first, it is voluntary. The companies are not required to label their products gluten-free if they choose not to do so. The one issue that people are have concerns about, and, you know, we're somewhat surprised, is that companies are not required to test their product. They have there are various ways that they can, you know, determine whether or not their product is safe, and it will depend, of course, on what the product is that they're making. For example, if all of the ingredients for your product are completely gluten-free, they don't come anywhere near gluten, and you're making your product in a gluten-free facility, the chances are that you do, and you've checked with the suppliers that the ingredients are clean, the chances are you may not need to, but the same would not be the case of, you know, somebody who is making cookies, where we know that grains have a tendency to have cross-contamination. So it is going to depend on what the product is and what the company feels is appropriate for what they're making. That said, from our perspective, good manufacturing practices, knowing who the product is going to, who you're making the product for, and that this is for a medically prescribed diet, we would hope that they are testing their products.
Well, and I also got another question about that, and it was that, you know, if the FDA is saying that the manufacturers don't have to test, then manufacturers may not be motivated to go through the time and the expense of testing or of getting certified. And I've heard this from a number of people who feel like that even the independent certifications are going to go by the wayside now because of this new FDA standard. And I happen to disagree, and I'll let you comment as well. I think, you know, as a food manufacturer myself, and my products are already certified by an independent certification agency, but I counsel other food manufacturers to all get certified. And this, to me, this FDA regulation doesn't change that at all, because what is the best way to assure the FDA and any consumer that you are following manufacturing best practices, that you are actually providing a safe product and that you are complying with the FDA rules? Get certified from an independent certification agency who even holds you to a higher standard. So to me, I don't see these agencies going by the wayside. I see them as having a new role, which is, you know, providing backup for all of these manufacturers who, you know, want to have a CYA, so to speak, for any claims that people might make that the foods that they're producing are out of compliance with the FDA rules. How do you feel about that?
Well, I think I agree with you. I tend to agree with you. I don't see that I think the certification companies are going to be overwhelmed with business. In part because, you know, we have seen so many companies come into the marketplace to try and get part of this try to get market share. And I think we will continue to see more companies coming in. And I think that those companies who are new to this and want to make sure they're doing it right, and I think that, you know, I will give them the benefit of the doubt that that is what they intend to do. They want to produce a good product so that it'll be purchased, that they're going to seek out the certification companies so that they can understand what is it that I should be doing, what is it that I shouldn't be doing, and have someone guide them through the process so they can get moving and get their product on the market. So I think that they are not going to go by the wayside at all.
Yeah, that's certainly, you know, the answer that I've been giving, is I think that there's going to be a clear need for them to have a continued presence in the marketplace. Moving on to a couple other points on this regulation, you said that we were kind of surprised, which we were, that there was not going to be a requirement for testing. One thing that I was surprised by as well, and I think you may have been, is that products that are naturally gluten-free are going to be allowed to be labeled as gluten-free. So even spring water and fruits and vegetables and eggs and things like that can now bear a gluten-free label without having the caveat of, you know, as are all eggs. That is a little bit unusual. We had not, I don't think, seen that one coming.
In reviewing the summary of the comments from FDA, they received numerous comments that the additional language that appeared that they had proposed as clarifying language was too confusing. And so rather than saying, okay, bottled water, really, it doesn't make sense for you to carry that label at all, and we won't have clarifying language. They decided instead to allow water to be labeled gluten-free, which I think will create a fair amount of confusion, not just on water, but on other products that you would never expect to see labeled gluten-free, and it was clear that the reason it was done was so that companies could, companies knew that a number of people with celiac disease buy products strictly if they're labeled gluten-free, and this will, help them going forward with additional sales. I think it's going to pose an issue for the community in terms of, should I even pay attention to that label on products like this? Is it necessary? And that's a level of education that one isn't, we would prefer not to have to deal with, but we're going to have to deal with it as we go forward, and it's unfortunate. And It's inconsistent with other approaches on food labeling, and you know, maybe that one will be revisited down the line.
Yeah. We'll see, because I can tell you it's I agree completely that I was surprised and disappointed that that was in there as it is. There is a large national grocery store chain that touts the fact that it has, you know, pages and pages of gluten-free products that they sell, and you walk in the store and they have a list that you can pick up and navigate through the store of all the gluten-free products. And I was so frustrated when I went in there even years ago and picked up the list, and the first three pages were all different flavors and types of bottled water. And, you know, so it made it look like they had a robust gluten-free offering, and they didn't. They had water, and then there were a couple of cereals. You know, it's like, this is very frustrating for a gluten-free consumer. They're on for so many different reasons, especially people who are new to the marketplace, the confusion that that type of labeling will cause. Well, if this bottle of water is labeled gluten-free and this one isn't, does that mean that water is not gluten-free? It's going to pose a lot of problems, but we'll have to address that as it comes. Another question that I've gotten about the new regulations that perhaps you could expound upon a bit is that products that contain grains, gluten, barley, rye, or wheat that contain gluten, they can still be labeled gluten-free if they have been processed to remove the gluten to less than 20 parts per million. Can you explain that a little bit?
That is correct. There are processes by which that these grains can basically have the proteins removed, and FDA has been aware of that, and what they're saying is if you can demonstrate that the proteins have been removed through a process that we agree that has been scientifically proven to do that, then those products may be labeled gluten-free.
And one example of that is something called Codex wheat starch, which was the Codex Alimentarius we were talking about earlier. There's a wheat starch product which actually is used quite a bit in Europe and has so far been rejected in this country by the consumers, not by the government, because it's wheat starch, and people
right.
are shocked to see wheat starch listed as an ingredient on a gluten-free product. And I think there's going to be a learning curve there as well. We'll see if it works in the United States. It did not when it was they tried to introduce it a number of years ago. It didn't really sit so well with the gluten-free population here. So it'll be interesting to see if anything changes with that now in the future, with new products coming in the market every day and international products coming in to the play as well, now that we have the same standard as the majority of other countries who have addressed this issue. There will be an expectation that there will be some more trade than we've had even in the past of gluten-free products. So we'll be I'll be interested to see if that flies here in the United States. People usually don't like to hear the word wheat if they're gluten-free. I don't think they want to see that on their labels. But to know if it's been processed, then that's going to be interesting. A couple other things that that this regulation didn't address, and one of them is, you know, sort of tangentially related to this discussion we were just having, is hydrolyzed and fermented foods, things like gluten-free, so-called gluten-free beers that are deglutenized because they
right.
are made from barley, but they have been processed to supposedly remove the gluten proteins. Were those covered by this FDA regulation?
The regulation does cover gluten-free beers that are made from a gluten, non-gluten grain, so sorghum, gluten-free sorghum beers are covered by the regulation. The FDA acknowledged that there are these other beers made from gluten-containing grains that reportedly are testing under 20 ppm. However, that the tests used by the company has not, while it has been validated for other purposes for the use in other foods, it has not been proven to be, has not been validated for the purposes of these types of alcoholic beverages for the beers. And FDA has said that they will go back to this issue and they will be issuing a proposed rule sometime in the future, they did not give a specific date, to revisit this issue and to take comments on the testing methods and additional science to see how they should proceed with regard to the testing of these products and whether they should come under the rule. So what happened is a year ago in May of 2012, the TTB, which regulates alcoholic beverages and beer, issued an interim guidance saying that their specific rule, products made with gluten-containing grains could not be labeled gluten-free. They had to have a caveat on it, even if they were testing below 20 ppm. And so they said once FDA comes out with its final ruling, then we will go back ourselves, TTB, and revisit the issue and decide how we want to proceed with regard to these products once we know what FDA is going to do. So both FDA and TTB will need to be working together now on this proposed rule that will come out sometime in the future.
And so just to be clear, beers that are, quote-unquote, deglutenized because they're made with barley, but they have gone through processing with certain enzymes that is supposed to take care of the hordeans, the glutens in the barley beers to make them gluten-free, they are not, under this rule, going to be allowed to be labeled gluten-free at this time. We're waiting
That's
to hear
correct.
From the FDA until
That's
that.
Correct. So, and the rulemaking process will be very similar to what we went through for the gluten-free rule. FDA will put out a proposed rule. Public comment will be taken. They will take all those comments back in. They will evaluate them, and then they will, you know, make a decision on how they want to proceed and issue a final rule. So I think that process is probably at least a couple years away.
They're probably done with us for a little while with FDA. Okay, well, I want to plow on because we've only got a few minutes left. Pharmaceuticals, are they covered by this rule?
No. Prescription medications are not covered by the regulation. However, FDA does acknowledge at the end of the summary on the final rule that they have already begun looking at the issue of prescription medications and what labeling may be needed and are looking into that. They did not give any time frame in which they would issue any final decision on what they were going to do there. We do know that they do not need any regulatory authority to do it. They can do it today.
Good.
If they make the decision that it should be done. That said, we have already taken steps and working with others in the community, working with members of Congress on legislation that would require labeling of prescription drugs if there are any gluten-containing ingredients. And that legislation was introduced by Congressman Tim Ryan out of Ohio, and it has not been introduced in the Senate, but there is some very significant interest in the Senate as well.
Okay, what about vitamins and other supplements like that?
Dietary supplements and vitamins are covered under the rule, yes.
Okay, and what about non-food products?
For example?
Well, I've gotten several
lotions.
Questions where people want to know about lotions and, cosmetics and things like that.
No. Actually, those are covered by a separate law completely that would be under FDA's jurisdiction, but the FALCPA only addressed food that is ingested. It did not address anything otherwise. So, no, it does not cover cosmetics.
Okay. And this is a big one. Everyone wants to know the answer to this one, and I'm not sure you even know it yet. What about restaurants?
The rule appears to indicate that, yes, it covers restaurants. We have asked for clarification from FDA on this point in plain English that we can explain for sure how restaurants, if they are covered, which I believe they are, how they would comply with the regulations. I haven't heard back from them. I'm hoping that we will have an answer soon. Now, that said, I do know that there are folks who have been in touch with restaurant industry officials, folks from within the celiac community, and they, you know, their response seems to be, if you are making claims on your menus that you're serving something gluten-free, they would hope that you are following the regulation, that in terms of protecting, you know, the restaurant itself, if you're going to be making claims, then you need to be able to be doing the right things to ensure that the what you're serving is safe. So, but I think it's going to be, that is going to be a whole educational process as well, in terms of how that will be done, you know, training for staff, all of that is going to need a lot of attention going forward.
Okay. So, like, we've discussed that this is not going to be in effect until next August, August of 2014. What happens at that point if a consumer purchases a product that is labeled gluten-free and they feel like they've been made sick by eating it because they feel like there was gluten in the product? What will be the consumer's avenue of recourse at that point under these regulations?
Well, this, even before 2014, if a consumer has a gluten-free product that they believe has made them ill and they believe that the reaction is because there was gluten in the product, they should report that to an FDA complaint coordinator. And we do have link. Both FDA has a link on their website, actually, I think, on the Q&A page for the gluten-free rule. To those coordinators, we have them on our website. I believe the other national celiac organizations also have it listed on their website. There's one in almost every state. And you would contact them and tell them, you know, what it is you ate. You please retain the original packaging. They're going to want to know UPC code on it, where you purchased it, all sorts of, you know, information like that, so they can track the product and see if, in fact, there may have been an issue within the production of the product.
And then what will the FDA's enforcement abilities, what will they have as options before them if they do find that a manufacturer has not complied with the labeling regulations and the standards set?
If FDA finds that, it will vary depending on what the infraction is, how
severe
the issue is. So if a product tests, instead of 20 parts per million, it tested at 25, I'm sure they would, you know, they may say, we think you need to test a little, maybe you should be testing your product if the company wasn't testing before. If they find something egregious, like a product is testing at 200 parts per million, they may have, they may send them an action letter telling them that they need to be pulling product off the shelves, and they need to be testing their product on a regular basis, and FDA may then go in and actually inspect the plant to see what's going on there. And, I mean, they can force recalls if necessary, if something is very, you know, extremely egregious. I'm only aware that that has happened one time with a gluten-free product, that it was so grossly mislabeled, or it wasn't the label that was wrong. It was the fact that it was had, you know, I think it was actually made with wheat products.
Right. It was put in the wrong packages.
Exactly.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Well, that's good to know. And can you also just provide the website for the American Celiac Disease Alliance for folks who want to learn more, to get updates when you learn more about the restaurants, and to get the links for what you were referring to if they did have a consumer complaint to the FDA?
Sure. Our website is www.americanceliac.org, and you can also sign up for our newsletter on the site, and we actually put out a very nice little 4 C's earlier this week that we're calling to help people learn and understand what the rule means, and the 4 C's are consistency, clarity, that it's consumer-friendly, and it will give consumers confidence that we now actually have a standard that all manufacturers will need to comply with.
Great. And if you want to learn more about the world's tallest gluten-free cake, which was actually over 11 feet tall, Andrea, not 10.
Oh, how could I do that?
You can, Yeah, you can go to 1in133.org and see all of the supporters of our movement and learn more about how that happened, see some pictures and some fun stuff for history besides this. You can also go to blog.julesglutenfree.com to read the article that was posted there on Friday about how far we've come and what this means to us as consumers. Thank you so much, Andrea, for all of your hard work on this and for taking the time to talk to us tonight. I really appreciate it, and we have a lot to look forward to.
Sure, and if folks have other questions and would like to send them our way, we're happy to try to answer questions. I know Jules is doing a magnificent job on that as well. You can just shoot them to info@americanceliac.org.
Great. Thanks so much, Andrea. Thanks for listening, and looking forward to seeing lots of gluten-free labels.
Yep. Have a good night, everybody.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
Dearly beloved, we are gathered here today to... Has anyone seen the bride and groom?
Sorry, sorry, we're here. We were getting lucky in the limo and we lost track of time.
No, Lucky Land Casino, with cash prizes that add up quicker than a guest registry.
In that case, I pronounce you lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Daily bonuses are waiting. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.